Welcome to All Sides with Anna Stafford. When we imagine a library, we think of a place where we take our kids to story time, a quiet place to study, a place to peruse new book titles, or just use the free Wi-Fi. But this picture doesn't exactly fit what's happening in many urban libraries across the country. They've become hubs for social services, battlegrounds for culture wars, and even places where, unfortunately, people overdose. Librarians are reporting rising levels of violence, abuse, and harassment from patrons, all of which take a toll on their mental health. We're exploring the challenges libraries face this hour, and we begin with librarian Lauren Comito. Lauren is executive director of Urban Libraries Unite, an advocacy group for some of the largest libraries in the country. Welcome to All Sides, Lauren.
Thank you for having me.
A recent New York Times article carried the headline, "Librarians Face a Crisis of Violence and Abuse," and it documented just how dire some of these situations are and how librarians are dealing with burnout, psychological trauma. So you're a librarian in New York City. Can you tell us a little bit about what that's like today?
Well, so what I will say is, for the most part, I help people find books, I help them print, make library cards. You know, that's generally what we do at the desk every day. And then sometimes other things happen, right? So particularly during sort of the COVID mitigation time where we were asking people to wear masks, people would sometimes throw them at us or yell at us, or I was called a Nazi once for asking someone to wear a mask. That was less than fun. And then as sort of a result of some of the shutdown things, people lost connection with their mental health services. And so because we are this sort of radically open space, people can come in if they're having a crisis, and sometimes do. And we had some incidents. For the most part, it's okay. The problem is that when it is bad, it's bad. And a lot of workers are trying to make up for holes in the social safety net libraries were never designed to fill.
Yeah, I used to live out in Denver, Colorado, and a number of years ago when I lived there, KUSA, the station that I worked for, did an investigation into their downtown library, and they found evidence of drug overdose, drug selling, abuse. Like, the librarians there were carrying Narcan because they would find people in the restrooms. And it's not the majority of the patrons that come to the library, but it was really taking a toll on them.
Yeah. And it's not even a majority of the unhoused patrons that come to the library
right, either.
I think that's something that I made the mistake of reading the comments on the Times article online.
That's never a good idea.
I shouldn't have done it. It was a problem. But so many people who don't have homes just come to the library to read the newspaper and books and use the computer just the same as everyone else does. It's not this, you know, they're not villains just because they're unhoused. And a lot of people who are housed are actually quite cruel in how they deal with frontline and retail and service workers, like librarians are.
Hundreds of library staff members surveyed in 2022 said they'd experienced violent or aggressive behaviors from patrons. Another survey that same year of 1,300 work employees found that more than 8,000 incidents were labeled as traumatic, such as threats, assault, harassment. Is this getting worse in recent years? Is it just, I mean, there's always angry people. There's always people who shout at customer service. But do you feel like it's getting more frequent?
Yeah. So in the 2022 study, that was ours, the Urban Library Trauma Study, we had one member of one of our focus groups called it a culture of casual cruelty. That we've sort of developed this culture of casual cruelty where you can just be mean to someone, either in a comment section or someone who's serving you at a counter. And a lot of that has increased. I definitely feel it differently than during, say, past crises, like the Great Recession, where I helped people find work. People were always really stressed out because they didn't have money for basic necessities. They needed a job. But it didn't feel like this.
Do you think the culture wars have played a role in this. There's been a lot of conversation in recent years, particularly around like school libraries, but it's extended to all libraries, about the kinds of books that people have, the kind of authors that come in, what kinds of books, you know, children under the age of 18 can check out or have access to.
Yeah, I think that has absolutely played a role. You know, whereas before we had a common conception of libraries as a space in the community for learning and for everyone, there seems to be this idea that that's a, on, in some areas, that that's a bad thing. There are, you know, I've worked at a library that was having, that was being protested before. It was less than fun. And we had to go through a lot of different procedures to keep everyone safe in, you know, both inside and outside the library, including staff. But when people are screaming at you that you're a pedophile at work, it's not great.
I would imagine. I can't imagine having to walk past a line of protesters every day just to go to work. That's got to be really unnerving.
Yeah. It's not every day, but when it does happen, you know, it is impactful. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is that we really want to make sure everyone's represented in the library, that that is incredibly important. And sometimes it's going to mean having books that people don't like. There's a lot of books I don't like, but I have to shelve them anyway.
That's fair. I think that's what would prohibit me from running a bookstore. You can't only sell the stuff that you want to read. Maybe you could. I don't know. I also want to invite all of you to join this conversation. Are you somebody who works in a library, or have you seen something that that's given you pause? If you've got an opinion or a comment that you'd like to share, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email allsides@wosu.org. Your organization, Urban Libraries Unite, recently started a peer-led virtual support group for library workers anywhere in the United States. How did that come about, and what's been the reception of it?
So that was one of the recommendations at the end of the trauma study. We worked really hard with our research to make it participatory for people who are experiencing the impacts of what's been happening in the libraries. And one of the things that was come up with in multiple working groups was the idea of a support network. So we took that recommendation and applied for further grants from the Institute of Museum and Library Services, and got a grant to do a prototyping of support groups for library workers. And so we launched in September. We have 6 groups a month, and approximately 80 people signed up so far. We've been slow launching so that we can fix the problems as they come up with a project like this. It's larger than something we've done before. We want to make sure it goes well for everyone.
Yeah. Is it just a place to like vent your frustrations, get best practices, share, or just have somebody that really understands what you're going through?
Yeah, essentially. It's we do have a rule that you don't get to tell anybody else what they should do.
That's
in fair. A lot of cases, it is just talking about the things that you're going through with other people who understand. Because one of the things that again came up in the focus groups in the study was that people felt really alone in their experiences. They didn't think anybody else was going through it. They thought it was just them and their own failure to be like the right kind of librarian or the right kind of library worker. And that's not the case. It is happening in so many different places, and people aren't by themselves.
The New York Times article referenced something that really stopped me in my tracks. And it was about patrons dying by suicide publicly with it. Like, this is, I mean, one person landing on a circulation desk. That, I would assume this is a very rare thing, but that has to be an incredibly traumatic experience.
I have heard from some people who've witnessed that, and it is an incredibly difficult thing for a staff to go through. I have not, and so I can't even wrap my head around what that must be like.
Yeah.
But I hope that when people have space to discuss things with other people, that they can sort of process some of it. That's kind of what the support groups are for, processing.
Yeah, I would definitely hope so. You know, I think it can be tempting to say that this is a problem only in big cities, only in places like New York City or San Francisco or Denver. But I want to say we will be talking with local librarians later in the hour, but this isn't just happening in our biggest cities. I hear from rural librarians facing similar struggles.
We actually had, so we were able to use about 450 responses in our study, but we had over 500 that, and some of them we had to exclude from our research because they weren't urban. But I hear about this all of the time, and there's some research out of the University of Washington that's studying all types of libraries and finding the same things we found are sort of universal. Rural libraries have some a lot of the same social societal pressures as urban libraries, with fewer community resources available to deal with them. And so we actually have a lot in common.
Yeah. I wonder, you know, one of the conversations that we have around policing is, and there's lots of conversations around policing, but one of them is that they're handling a lot more people with mental health issues, that there's a lot of that the care isn't there, the beds aren't there, the wraparound support services aren't there. And it sounds like in a lot of ways, libraries are catching a lot of these folks who are slipping through the cracks as well.
Yes, absolutely. And it's, we don't have the services to provide them to help them with their mental health. Some libraries have social workers, and that is a big help. And that's a spreading sort of way of handling these situations. But what we can do is say hello to the people that walk in our door that are our neighbors and recognize them and know who they are and say their names, so they hear them at least once a day. I think we have a lot of really lonely neighbors and patrons who come to the library to be around other people. And even if we can't provide the social services they need because it's outside the mission of the library, we can still know their names. And that does a lot for people.
Yeah, I think so. Even in a big city like New York City, you can recognize the regulars. That makes me feel better about the
Yeah.
universe just a little bit.
New York City is a bunch of small towns squished up right next to each other. You know, it's big, but we all know everybody in our neighborhoods.
I do wonder, that sounds so interesting. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's good, but also a little sad that libraries are adding social workers. Like, it's not a bad thing to provide services where people need them or where they're turning up, but it's, I just feel like, I don't know what it says. It just, something about it makes me feel a little sad inside, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so libraries are really about providing access to information and meeting people's information needs. And as those information needs change, we adapt. So, where in the early 1900s, it was kids getting out of the factories wanting to read penny westerns and people writing letters to the New York Times saying, hey, stop carrying these penny westerns in the libraries. This isn't what we need to be doing with our libraries. Now it's people looking for housing and trying to make connections with services because we have, you know, we have the society where everyone's needs aren't being met. And all of those needs that aren't being met involve accessing information, using technology, filling out forms. And that's the sort of thing that libraries can provide, is that information access. Bringing social workers in helps us do that.
We're going to take a quick break, but coming up, local librarians are going to share the issues they're confronting right here at home. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Stever. Libraries offer all kinds of free resources to the public, even warmth on a cold day or air conditioning when it's hot and sunny out. But librarians across the country are taking on more than they initially signed up for. Libraries have increasingly become a place where social issues come to a head. Still with us is Lauren Camito, Executive Director of Urban Libraries Unite, and joining the conversation from the Columbus Metropolitan Library are Christiana Bernard, Information Service Specialist, welcome to All Sides, and Charlie Hansen, the Chief Customer Experience Officer. Welcome to All Sides, Charlie.
Thank you.
Christiana, you were quoted in the New York Times article that inspired today's show, and you talked about compassion fatigue. Can you share what that means?
Absolutely. That is a term that I believe originated in social work. It is really just the cumulative mental toll of helping people whose basic needs aren't being met and seeing the ways in which needs often outpace available resources. And it's a really tricky thing to handle because I will say, and I'm glad Lauren mentioned it earlier, this idea that homeless people are the problem in libraries is so far from the truth in my experience. Frankly, a lot of our regulars at Main Library are unhoused, and they're honestly my favorite people to work with. I see them every day for hours a day. But there is a real mental toll that comes from situations like calling the homeless hotline to find someone a bed and a shelter for the evening and learning there aren't beds available. That's a really hard thing to take with you when you want to support your community as best you can.
Yeah, Charlie, it seems like more and more libraries are becoming community centers. Is that a fair assessment, do you think, in terms of the way people experience and use the library?
I hesitate to say that because we have community centers in our community as well, and I think they play a very important role. I think, again, Lauren hit on it earlier in terms of we will continue to evolve and adapt to what our communities and customers need and want from us. And so I think that's a great feature of public libraries, is that we are so flexible and are so adaptable to our community's needs. And so that's what I see that's going on, and being responsive to the customers that we're seeing in our buildings.
How are you guys at the Columbus Library helping? What kind of training, services, counseling, what do you do to take care of your librarians?
Sure. Yeah, I can speak to a few things, and maybe Christiana can add some things from her perspective. So like a lot of employers, we have an employee assistance program where we partner with a provider for that. And so that offers counseling sessions, free counseling sessions for our staff that they can seek out on their own. I think, you know, the current climate has necessitated us to bring that relationship even closer to the library with our EAP provider, and also providing opportunities for our staff to interact directly with those services without having to go through some of the hoops you have to do to set that up on your own. I think that strikes me sometimes, like someone experiences a traumatic incident and then they have to go through this process and jump through hoops. They're not always in a position to do that. So how do we bring those services more directly? Also do a fair amount of, actually a significant amount of security training, just physical security training. So we have a monthly security drill that all of our locations go through to go through our emergency response plans. We also offer de-escalation training, in-person de-escalation training for staff to handle those situations. I will say, I think training is something that we certainly want to do for these types of, for the environment that we're working in and the situations that we're seeing. But I will say it's a struggle with training, because how do you prepare yourself for some of these things, I think, can be really tricky. So I just want to mention the limits of some of that too. So I don't know if you have anything to add, Christiana.
Absolutely. I'll say, as I'm an information services specialist, so I spend half or more of my work day at a reference desk out on the floor. And when it comes to supporting staff mental health, I think one of the biggest protective factors that I experience is a healthy workplace culture. In my division, I am really fortunate to have managers that are trauma-informed, who are comfortable discussing mental health, and will even use, I think, appropriate self-disclosure when necessary to just set that stage and acknowledge that when you're dealing with things in the workplace that shouldn't be happening in a workplace, your mental health needs just look different. There's a phrase in trauma-informed care of empowerment, voice, and choice, and that is something I experience regularly after an incident. So empowerment looks like being told by my managers that I have options. If I feel unsafe, I can walk away from the desk. Is it great customer service? No, but my safety is more important. When it comes to voice, we actually recently met with the new director of security and mentioned one of the ways in which one of our service expectations was inadvertently causing conflict with a regular who was having some paranoid delusions. And she worked with us to kind of come for a compromise for how to handle that particular policy so that we're still, promoting safety, but not causing an incident that we knew would happen if this particular customer was asked to provide photo ID to get a guest pass. And lastly, just choice. I have had mental health crises at work. I've had panic attacks at work. And in the aftermath, my managers have given me the option of going home for the day if that's something I want to do, or staying. And I think having those lines of communication open, I think the most recent time it occurred, I stayed at work the whole day and said, I'll feel better if I know I can make it through this day. And I may change as the day goes along if something else happens. So just having those open lines of communication, using that trauma-informed care framework makes a tremendous difference in my mental health.
Thank you for sharing. Is that, you don't have to answer if you don't want to. Totally up to you, whatever you're comfortable with. But are those related to situations at the library?
Yes, they have been related to situations in the library. I will say, like, I'm very open about this. I have my own mental health journey. I was actually diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder when I was 6 years old. So it's been a lifelong journey. So for me, and I think this is a really important facet of trauma-informed care, the thing that sets me off might not be the obvious thing. I mean, I had an incident in which a customer who was experiencing a very severe mental health crisis vividly described wanting to kill me in details about that.
Oh my
And
goodness.
that doesn't necessarily rattle me in the same way that a seemingly smaller incident might. So just having that openness and recognizing that
That it's
the thing
different
that
for
we're experiencing,
everyone.
absolutely.
I want to take a call from Brenda in Columbus. She's a retired librarian. Brenda, welcome. Are you there? I think we're having a little bit of technical difficulties. We'll move on and try to circle back with her later. One of the issues that has been rising in the news over the past couple of years is book banning. Now, this happens a lot more in schools than it does in public libraries, but we do hear about book challenges, questions about what children can access. And I asked Lauren about this, but I'd love to get your guys's take, because it's something that people get real worked up about. Like, should how did my 15-year-old like check out a book that has sex scenes in it?
Yeah, Christiana, if you're seeing
Yeah.
any of that.
Not really. I feel remarkably fortunate. I'm currently doing a graduate program through the University of Alabama, a distance learning program, and what I see in my day-to-day is nothing like what my classmates in Alabama are facing. I have had I think one or two incidents in which someone was upset by the content of a book. And I've referred them to our collection development policy. And spoken very openly that there are things on the shelves that I do not agree with, and I'm glad they're there because the things that I need, the resources I need, are things that other people don't agree with. That intellectual freedom is a gift and is a necessity for us to do the work we have to do.
It looks like Brenda is now ready. So, Brenda, retired librarian from Columbus, welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to mention a couple of things. One is that libraries always have two policies that deal with this issue. One is a book selection policy, which is how they choose materials. And they also always have a policy that is followed when a book is challenged by the public or an individual. And in that, they fill out a short questionnaire. They are asked if they have read the book, which in many cases they have not. And they are simply, in communities that are being challenged, they have simply been given a list of excerpts from certain books that they're to feed into these things. Libraries are there to serve everyone. And I used to explain to my customers that they had a right to read anything they wanted, just like I did. and it might be different. They have a right to limit what their children read, but not what my child could read. And I always tried in my selection, when we were doing our own selection for the branches, which has been a while back, to have a wide variety of things that were needed in my community, which would have not been needed in another community, because I worked in an urban situation in a neighborhood that was fairly poverty bound. So people need to understand that there are processes to go through to challenge a book, and that this isn't something that we've never dealt with before, but we do expect them to come to it with knowledge of what they are complaining about. So,
yeah, thank you so much, Brenda. Lauren, is that pretty standard across all libraries that they're, how they select books is an open door, like an open policy, how they challenge? Does that sound about right?
Yeah. It's industry standard to have a policy for both things.
Right.
Yeah.
Other flashpoints cited in the Times article, Lauren, that I would love to get your take on, related to internal operations like worker retention, aging buildings, conflicts with administrators. How do you see those issues sort of factoring into these conversations?
Well, when it's hot, people are grouchy.
That's
so
fair.
The fact that most libraries across the country are dealing with an aging, you know, HVAC infrastructure at the same time that climate change is raising temperatures in the library is unfortunate. I've worked in a couple over the last few years where there it will hit 82 degrees inside, and then there are actually studies that show that test scores go down for every degree a room goes up when kids are taking tests. There are studies that show that people get angrier when it gets hotter. So like HVAC is vital for workplace safety in a number of ways.
Yeah. And sometimes libraries, particularly downtown ones, like the downtown one here in Columbus, is this beautiful, it's sort of a hybrid building, but it's got this beautiful old facade, these big marble like floors. It's very pretty, very old, sometimes very expensive to maintain.
They're almost always very expensive to maintain, the old beautiful ones. And they're not built for modern HVAC systems or like electricity. So you have to do a lot of modifications while maintaining the building itself. I'm in an interesting position with regards to conflicts with administrators. I know that a lot of my colleagues go through that. I'm an executive director in my second job, and also, you know, a middle manager, and I have a certificate in public library administration. So I have a different way of seeing how administrators are behaving and why they're, I have a different understanding of why they're doing what they're doing. I don't always agree with the decisions, but I can usually see the thought process and the underlying structures that got them there. Sometimes I think if that was communicated better, the underlying reasoning behind decisions that make, you know, especially when it comes to personal safety or health, that people would react better. And that we could just have a more holistic conversation that would leave everyone feeling safer in general.
Charlie, like I was just mentioning how pretty the downtown library is at Columbus, but it does kind of lead into a question about levies, because in this last election, library levies did pretty well across our state. Majority of them passed. People seem to want to fund them, but it's always that delicate dance, isn't it, between you want to have enough money to run the library, to offer the services people depend on, but I don't know. It's, you got to go ask them to spend even more of their hard-earned money for it.
Sure. Yeah. I always want to be thoughtful about when you're making that ask of the community. And then when you have the resources, making sure that you're good stewards of them, right? To balance all of the different considerations and things that cost money, and safety and security being a part of that, whether that's, you know, through security officers or some of the equipment and hardware and other environmental things you need to do to ensure a safe environment.
Yeah. You know, one of the things I can't help but see parallels in my own industry, in that there's a lot more conversation in the last couple of years about trauma health. Like, if you're the first at a shooting, how do you handle that? How do you take steps away? Like, I think it's just this conversation that we're having more as society. Does that make sense, Christiana, to say that, like, in every industry that might touch on traumatic events, there's much more conversation about, okay, what is the impact of seeing it firsthand?
Absolutely. And I'm honestly really excited about that. I know it's not comfortable to talk about. I know it's not easy to talk about. And we are, you know, actively pushing against the stigma about talking about mental health in the workplace. I think for most of, you know, the history of the United States, that's been a private thing you keep to yourself. But I really do think, just looking at the fact that we've come out of a massive social trauma on the pandemic, it makes sense that we're seeing more frustration, irritability, violence, harassment, because when people don't have the basic needs that they need to survive, when people are feeling just economically stressed and worried about their quality of life, they're not their best selves. And that's true of anyone.
Yeah. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about the move to unionize library workers and more about the economics of libraries themselves, excuse me. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
No matter what happens in Washington, the NPR Politics Podcast is here for you. For the latest news, insights, and analysis from the election and beyond, listen to the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking with librarians this hour, both here in Columbus and across the country, about their shifting roles as libraries have become hubs for social services and battlegrounds for culture wars. Still with us is Lauren Comito, Executive Director of Urban Libraries Unite. They're an advocacy group from some of the largest libraries in the country. She's also a librarian in New York City. We also have from the Columbus Metropolitan Library, Christiana Bernard, the Information Services Specialist, and Charlie Hansen, Chief Customer Experience Officer. In 2021, Worthington Libraries here in Central Ohio unionized after concerns about policies dealing with health and safety. In May, Upper Arlington voted to unionize. Lauren, is that something you're seeing more and more of across the country?
Yeah, I mean, I think we've had a unionization sort of wave in a lot of industries, but I'm definitely seeing an increased union formation in libraries across the country as well.
Maybe a difficult question for you guys over in Columbus, but is that something that you guys have talked about at all?
Well, I wouldn't be part of the bargaining right. union, so I wouldn't speak to that.
But. It is interesting. I don't know, Christiana, do you have any colleagues in Worthington? Have you heard anything about how it's going over there?
Yeah, I actually recently, for a school project, interviewed a children's librarian at Worthington, and she spoke really positively of her experience. The thing she said, and I think this is true for any relationship between frontline staff and administration, whether it's within the context of a union or not, is this idea that there is an island in the middle of the stream, and that is our shared goal. And we often assume that we have to yell at each other from opposite sides of the stream and convince the person to come over to our other side. And what she's found positive about that experience is this idea that we can meet in the middle. And I think that idea of meeting in the middle, whether you're unionized or not, is so necessary. Just keeping those lines of communication open, ensuring that the people who the policies impact the most can provide that feedback. Because the reality is, even the best intention policies haven't been, you know, battle tested in real world conditions. And that's what happens every day for us.
We had a question come in from a listener named Marilyn who wanted to know how Columbus is integrating mental health services or partnering maybe with other nonprofits to help folks who come through your doors.
Sure, I can speak to a couple of those things, and I think a lot of other public libraries are doing this too. I think leveraging partnerships in our communities through social service organizations and people who can bring the expertise maybe that we don't have to the table. So we partner with a number of different organizations around addiction services, signing up for public benefits, healthcare on a lot of levels. And so if we don't have that expertise in-house, we're going to work with a partner to bring it in-house to do that. And that's been really helpful. And I think Lauren, I think mentioned before the radical open access to libraries. That's a real benefit in that regard, because oftentimes the agencies are looking for that type of access to their clients, right? And so we can provide that, and that's been really helpful.
Oh, that's great. I have a question about burnout. So I think librarians, perhaps I could be wrong, have something similar to what those of us in the journalism field have, this strong sense of mission, of the importance of the work that you do and what it means to the community you serve. And I wonder whether that can push you sometimes, I don't know if I'm tattling on myself here, to stay later than you should, work harder, work longer, maybe burn the candle at both ends a little bit to get all the services out to the community.
Yeah, that is a very real struggle. There's actually a term for it in the field of librarianship called vocational awe. There is an article in a journal called In the Library with a Lead Pipe by Fabazzi et al. About this idea we have about public libraries as these almost secular sanctuaries of intellectual freedom. And with any sort of religious calling, there can be that implicit, like, you're willing to give up anything to further this mission. And my stance on it is that we understand that if we don't have a book on the shelf, we cannot put it in the hands of customers. And mental health is the same. If we do not prioritize our mental health, if we don't take steps to consciously cultivate that sense of inner safety we need to make our customers and communities feel safe, we can't provide that to others. And I really think there's this that human element of the work is something I'd love for us to just talk about more explicitly, develop a shared vocabulary and strategies for managing that.
Lauren, is that something you see too in librarians that you speak with? I guess you, Christiana, called it vocational awe. I like that.
Yeah, I absolutely see that at burnout. My take on it tends to be, okay, so if we are important and if we are this vital center of community, then we have to take care of ourselves in order to continue the work we're doing. So we have to step back at the end of a work day, because otherwise tomorrow we won't be as effective. That it's part of keeping us everything going. And that I have a tendency to overwork. I mean, I have two jobs, three in the spring. What are you gonna do?
Oh my goodness.
I definitely deal with stress by working. So it's a constant sort of back and forth with me personally to not overwork myself, but also with the staff that I work with to stop them. Be like, you could tell them they can't email me at 1 in the morning to wait in the morning. I know you're up, but wait till 10 o'clock tomorrow. It's fine.
Yeah, I always go back and forth on that too. I'll be like, if I send an email late at night, I'll be like, do not respond right now. I just had a thought and I don't want to lose it, so I'm sending it. But even that feels guilty.
I go back and forth on whether it's a good idea to teach people how to schedule emails or not, whether I'm
Oh.
enabling it or I
I
don't,
just have that
or
fear,
protecting
right?
myself.
If you don't put it out when you're thinking about it, like it'll just whew, leave right out of your head. Yeah, I wonder. You know, to circle back to the tax issue and the levies, I wonder if you would like what you might want to see. If you could wave a magic wand and change the way that public libraries are funded, would you make any changes? And I guess I can start with y'all over at the Columbus Library.
If we would change any way that we're funded,
Yeah,
no,
like,
I think
no?
no. I mean, I think we benefit from some very robust community support, and in Ohio, also some great state support, funding support. So I think we're in a very positive position as far as funding goes, particularly at CML. So yes.
Yeah, funding accomplishes so much. Something I regularly think about as a frontline staff member is we have in-house security. Security is part of our, our organizational staff. They're not contractors. And I know sometimes the public might see that and think like, why are you spending so much money on security officers? And what I can tell you from the experience of having in-house security is it makes a world of difference because you have a shared vision, a shared mission, and some of those intangibles, like being able to pick up on body language. Because these are security officers who see me each day at the desk, they know when I'm plastering on a fake smile because I feel uncomfortable. They know when I'm about to ask someone to leave. They can pick up on that. And I think having those relationships with security officers, having such a robust security workforce, honestly, for me, makes a world of difference. I've written, compared to one of the librarians interviewed in the New York Times article who wrote, I think, over 170 incident reports in a year, I've written 50 over the course of nearly 3 years. That's a big difference.
Yeah, that is a huge difference. I want to take a call from Flynn in Columbus. Welcome to All Sides.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
I'm doing well. Well, I had a question about the forthcoming work that I see going into the librarian's work. I know we've got a lot of burnout that's already being talked about, and with there being an influx of people that are supposed to be coming to live in Columbus, Ohio, and all these resources that are going to be needed as libraries are becoming hubs for, well, everything now. What are we going to be doing about the employment numbers of how many librarians we're hiring in the workforce? Because I know going to certain libraries, I only see a few librarians at a time. There may be like five or six working at some of the smaller ones, medium-sized ones or what have you, but that could just be certain at a time. As far as shifts go, how many shifts they're going to need to be. How many people are we talking about trying to cover the work that needs to be done by the future librarian?
Thanks, Flynn. That is a good question. We're going to get some estimates in Central Ohio of 1 million people in the next 20, 30 years. Going to be a
Yeah,
lot of new library patrons.
sure. Yeah, and I think always thinking towards the future and what's going on demographically, and that certainly fits into our facilities plans and where we plan to renovate and expand buildings or add buildings. So definitely something on our mind. And I think that tells me too that working with these community partners will continue to be an important thing because we've just seen how one shift locally can change what we're seeing in our locations in terms of what our customers need and who's showing up. So I think we'll continue to have to be flexible and also continue to be collaborative and cooperative within our community to serve all those needs.
Yeah, and I do want to be clear, when I say Central Ohio, I do mean like there's like 12 counties in this region that I'm counting
Right.
for that 1 million population growth, like Delaware, Licking, all of like the surrounding collar counties. It's not just Columbus, although I think Columbus is slated to get a few hundred thousand, so it's nothing to sneeze at in terms of growth. Cleveland.com in March reported that Maple Heights Library offers childcare to the community. And I thought that was such a fascinating idea of trying to establish childcare at a library. Lauren, have you heard of anything like that before? Or I think that's kind of like, I
Yeah,
had never heard of it.
actually, there's a couple of libraries in New York City that have universal pre-K.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so when universal pre-K came up about 6 years ago, I think it's Woodhaven and Ravenswood in Queens implemented actual universal pre-K in the library. So you go to pre-K, and then if you want story time, you just go right upstairs. And it's right in the community, which is fun because there is a library in every community. Not all, only two had the UPK, but it's a really great way of integrating children into using the community, the library from, kind of birth, but
Yeah.
3 years old.
It seems like a really clever solution too, because one of the challenges school districts have when, if you ever mandate universal pre-K, is where are we going to put the kids? Are we going to have to build new buildings? Do we put them in like ex accessory trailers? And I never thought of that, but like,
Yeah.
yeah, you could just put them at the library.
And it wouldn't work in every
Oh,
building.
no.
These two built, yeah, these two place spaces had space that had been being used for something else that had been moved elsewhere. We couldn't do it everywhere because we still have our regular services, but it can work in, sort of specific instances.
Any plans to put a pre-K in the Columbus Library?
It's something we've thought about and
Oh,
looked at. We've actually
really?
toured the Maple Heights branch just to take a look at, I think to Lauren's point, what from a building and facility perspective would be required to do that. No concrete plans at the moment, but always looking to serve. And also with our focus on getting kids ready for kindergarten, something that we will continue to consider. One thing that's important for us is to figure out, well, how does that fit into the overall pre-K network, in the community? And would we be helping or not by doing that? So something we want to be thoughtful about.
Yeah.
And then how's it funded becomes the question. So in New York City, pre-K is funded through the Department of Education. They get funding to run those programs that's separate from library funding,
Yeah, we gotta.
which is important.
Yeah, for sure. In Ohio, we don't mandate all day kindergarten yet. So, got a couple of steps probably before we would even consider universal pre-K. During the election season, we talked a lot on this show and with other people about being kind to poll workers, giving them grace, on not yelling at them if you don't have your ID or this, that, or the other. I wonder if you would say the same thing to people who come in and talk to librarians or staff. Just take a breather before you shout. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Yes.
I know one of my mental health strategies is to navigate the bad emotions when they come up, the hard emotions, the anger, the fear, give myself time to work through those and to savor the good. So when something good happens, I will oftentimes write it down in my journal because the human brain is biased towards negativity for our survival. It can be really easy to forget the good stories when they happen, but those are the things that keep me going and keep me wanting to do this work. So yes, please be kind to library staff and trust that we want you to find the resource you want to. We want what you want. Like, we want what is best for you. Sometimes the resources don't exist, but we will do our level best to connect you with what we can.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that I do now is I am so incredibly overly nice to every service worker I come across as much as possible. Because, you'll walk up and you'll hear somebody yelling at, say, a pharmacy workers. Some pharmacy workers are having a major issue with this. It's
Yeah.
specifically to the point where some pharmacies are closing for part of the day because they just, I don't. They can't be yelled at like this anymore.
Yeah, at my local pharmacy for a long time now, there's been a sign that says, "We are severely short-staffed. We apologize for the waits." And I'm just like, okay.
I love the signs that say, "We will be kind to you, but you have like the you need to be kind to us. If you yell at our staff, that's unacceptable." Just to see that in, I was in London. Every museum had a "You cannot abuse our staff"
Oh
sign
my
by the
goodness.
door. Buckingham Palace had one. A local elected official has to have one because people get yelled at so much there. We have a problem. We are not kind to each other, and it gets taken out on front desk staff. And that's what library workers really are, is the front desk of kind of society.
Yeah, a while back, I got an email that a book was ready to get picked up at my local library. I went. It actually wasn't ready. It was like a misstep, and like the woman just like braced. I could see her like bracing for me to yell at her, and I was like, "No, it's okay. It kind of sucks, but it was only like 10 minutes of my day. We're cool." And I just felt so bad that we're in a place where she's like, "Oh God, she's gonna scream at me." Hopefully,
Yeah.
I don't look like somebody who would scream at people, but I guess you never know.
You truly do not know. And I
Oh,
think that, yeah, like that is something I think about a lot is just holding contradictions in your head of needing to be aware of what's going on in the space, needing to be alert while also projecting welcome. And that is a big ask for a human brain because those are two very different processes. So having grace with myself, if I have a tricky interaction, unless there's someone waiting, main library is a big building. I will do a lap of the floor because I do not want to carry that tension and stress and discomfort into my next interaction with a customer.
yeah, I grew up working retail, so I think like anybody who's worked in like frontline service like has this sense of like, oh no, people can be terrible. Like I gotta be super duper extra nice. Or at least that's what you might hope. We're just about out of time, so I want to say thank you to Lauren Comito, the executive director of Urban Libraries Unite, who's also a librarian in New York City. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you to Christiana Bernard, Information Service Specialist at the Columbus Metropolitan Library.
Thank you so much, Anna. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about this.
And Charlie Hansen, the Chief Customer Experience Officer for the Columbus Libraries. Thank you.
Thanks. Happy to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, and I want to say thank you to all of our staff who make this possible, to producers Marcus Charleston and Aaron Esmont Rabinowitz, our interns Kira Kadar, David Stein, and Chris Corcoran. Video production today was by the Ohio Channel, and the board operator was Chris Johnston. And most importantly, thank you all for listening to All Sides, right here on 89.7 NPR News.